Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host is Thomas Drance. He covers the team for The Athletic. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Big day in the world of hockey today. Two big games, of course, game six of the Stanley Cup final with the Stanley Cup in the building in Florida as they look to clinch their second consecutive Stanley Cup trophy. And then also the Abbotsford Canucks hosting their first Calder Cup playoff game in franchise history. Their first home game, I should say, of course. It's game three of the series tonight in Abbotsford. Lots to get into on both of those fronts today. Drance, how you doing, man?
Doing well, buddy. Yeah, excited to talk hockey today and take a break, I suppose, from, you know, the usual Vancouver exercise of speculating. And
we're absolutely not going to take a break from that. We're going to do that too. Don't worry. That's part of the other stuff we have to get into. Do not take that off the table for us. Don't take that off the table.
I won't. Excuse me. There's a lot going on though, right? You've got,
oh yeah,
Calder Cup final game. You've got a potentially decisive Stanley Cup final game, which could launch, right, the start of this offseason.
Mm-hmm.
You've also got, you know, more people speculating about the state of Canucks ownership. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, there certainly is. And look, we'll get to the speculation in the offseason and the rumor mongering and, you know, more people out there connecting Bowen Byram to the Vancouver Canucks, more discussion about their fit as a trade partner with the Buffalo Sabres in general. We can get into all of that. But yeah, we should start with the actual tangible hockey games being played today, especially because they are really significant. And we'll start down in Florida, where, as mentioned, the Stanley Cup in the building, game six of the final tonight. Edmonton looking to extend the series and push a game seven back in Edmonton. And to that end, Stuart Skinner will come back and get the start in net, replacing Calvin Pickard. John Klingberg and Kasperi Kapanen both come back in. Troy Stetcher and Victor Arvidsson come out. So, I mean, really, one of the themes of this series has been the churn at the bottom of the Edmonton lineup, right? Looking for that recipe, that successful recipe, that successful mix to try to counter the depth, the incredibly impressive depth that Florida has. Florida's lineup has been much, much more stable than Edmonton's throughout this series. And, you know, I think the headline question going into today was who's going to get the start in net. I'm not surprised it's Stuart Skinner. And I think if you think about this situation, one of the arguments against putting Stuart Skinner in, like if this was a different team, would be, you know, have we damaged his confidence too much by pulling him? And now can we really go back to him? But this is old hat for Stuart Skinner. Like he knows what to do. He knows how to handle this situation at this point. What is this, like three or four times over the last couple of playoff runs that he's lost the net only to regain it over the course of the same series? So I'm not surprised at all that they, you know, this is part of the playbook that has worked for Edmonton. They've done it over and over in the past. Stuart Skinner has often responded really well. The team has often responded really well. And ultimately, he's your number one guy. So backs against the wall, elimination game. I'm not surprised at all that they're going to Stuart Skinner.
No, they had to do it. I mean, look, credit to Pickard, Stu. I thought he was really good after, you know, he came in game four, mm-hmm, right? Made some really critical saves, especially with his pads, like some of those down low chances that the Panthers had, that save on Barkov early in the third period. But he also loses his net a little too much.
Yep.
I mean, he's not as good as Skinner. Like, I don't know what else to say. Skinner might not be a Stanley Cup caliber starting goaltender, but he's, you know, a superior goaltender capable of giving you better results than Pickard over larger samples of games. And the Oilers need to have their best goalie in tonight. This is a legacy defining game for this team, potentially. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you lose this series, it's one thing, right? But if you lose this series in fewer games than it took the Panthers to beat you the year before, it's like, you know, it's, I mean, there's so little to choose from between these two teams. I don't think we should look at either of these teams as anything less than championship caliber, but there's only one Stanley Cup to go around.
Mm-hmm.
The Oilers are up against it. And, here we go. Like, well, and they need to win this game. It needed to be Skinner.
And I think it's not just, you're right, because I don't think it's going to be fair to like, oh, they didn't even do as well as they did last year. Like, if you lose in seven versus you lose in six, whatever, right? Like, it was a hard fought, close series, bunch of overtime games in there. That's fine. I think the more concerning thing for Edmonton going forward was just be some of the questions they have to answer. And frankly, the age of their roster. So many of their key players are, you know, not just like, oh, he's turning 30 next year, but well into their 30s already, right? Like Zach Hyman, Evander Kane, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Matthias Ekholm. Like, their age is really a concern with their supporting cast. And already one of the big conversations we're having about this series is the degree to which their supporting cast does not stack up to Florida's. So I don't want to say, it's not as if, oh, their window is closing or anything like that. You have McDavid and Draisaitl, your window's open, and you can always reload, and you can always figure things out. But I don't think it's as simple as, you know, just pencil these two teams to meet again next year should Edmonton lose this series, because I think there are some major questions that they're going to have to answer about this roster going forward, and they're going to have to try to figure out. Again, they'll have other opportunities as long as you have McDavid and Draisaitl, but to come so close twice and miss, that's going to sting, especially with a bit of an uncertain future there going forward too.
Yeah, and I mean, truthfully, this in some ways is their best chance. Like, this is,
it very well could end up being their best chance.
Yeah, no, but win or lose, like, this is their sort of, in some ways, the last run for this era of the Edmonton Oilers, regardless of the outcome. I mean, Draisaitl's going to jump from 8.5 to $14 million next season. McDavid becomes extension eligible on July 1. You've got Evan Bouchard as a pending, like, he's going to be an RFA after this season. He's had a $3.9 million cap hit while scoring a gajillion goals. I mean, I don't even want to know how much he's going to be. There are arduous choices, even beyond the age, just from a team construction standpoint. Like, there's no world in which this Oilers team can look the same. Mm-hmm. It's not to say they won't be better. It's not to say they won't look worse, but they pushed a lot of chips in on this. And part of that is, look, they got older, right? Broberg was allowed to walk when the Oilers decided not to match. Holloway was allowed to walk when the Oilers decided not to match the St. Louis offer sheet. They traded Ryan McLeod, right? Like, this team, they loaded up with Arvidsson and Skinner. Like, they loaded up on older players. But they lost a lot of guys in their mid-20s who, you know, are guys who maybe they didn't feel were ready to win now with us, right? Well, okay. You know, you've won a lot now, right? Like, you are in the Stanley Cup final for a second consecutive year. No matter what, we are going to remember this team and talk about this team for decades to come. It's just a question of how, right? And in what tone, and whether this will be another opportunity missed, you know, against a lights out Florida Panthers team that, damn, I mean, their runway is way clearer going forward than Edmonton, right? In some ways, this is like the game, the series of games that the Edmonton Oilers better be the more desperate team. They are the more desperate. And that's even with Bennett and Ekblad expiring and on and on. So, yeah, I mean, this is going to be a fascinating clash tonight. How do the Oilers even manage this pressure? Because all of this is very real, very present now that they're on the verge of elimination. And granted, you know, this team's come back from any number of wild situations here. But now that they're on the verge of elimination in the Stanley Cup final against the same opponent that defeated them last year, it just feels kind of suffocating. You've been talking about
it. Yeah, and just to put it in perspective, like, after McDavid and Draisaitl, their most used forwards at 5-on-5 in this series, Evander Kane, 33, 1 year left on his deal. Connor Brown, 31, UFA. Corey Perry, 40, UFA. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, 32, right? So, like, there's a lot of uncertainty in that group, and those are your third through six. Those are the four guys effectively rounding out your top six in terms of 5-on-5 minutes. Look, you could absolutely get great years from now. Obviously, Zach Hyman's not included in that, but he's getting older as well. And you could absolutely get fantastic years from Nuge and Zach Hyman next year. But there's a ton of uncertainty and a ton of questions as well for that forward group, especially. And then you throw Matthias Ekholm and Evan Bouchard's raise in on the back end as well. What do you make of the decision to bring John Klingberg back into this series?
Yeah, I mean, Troy Stetcher played, what, 4 minutes in game five?
Yeah.
Game four. Wasn't really the answer in game five. Had a tough go. I would have liked to see 11-7. That's the truth. Like, I think the Oilers should go 11-7. I think it gives them the best opportunity to disguise their matchups. And I think they just need to play pond hockey, but not obviously structurally, but in terms of how they're managing their lines here. Like, they're going to need to have short leashes on everybody. They're going to need to dig deep into their bag to find a spark. And I just think 11-7 would have given them the most malleability to do so. And to up McDavid's minutes and up Dreisaitl's minutes. I mean, those guys are going to play 32 minutes anyway. So why not go into it knowing that and being explicit about it and empty the tank here? Because, again, this is going to define Knobloch's legacy. This is going to define the Oilers' legacy. It's probably not going to define McDavid and Dreisaitl's legacy, but, man, it's going to be the first sentence on how we remember them.
Not necessarily. Not if they go in and win a cup in a couple years. That will be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but even then, you'll describe it in the context of what came before.
Sure.
Right? Like, they overcame two devastating back-to-back losses in the cup final and won the cup in.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying it's a negative end to the story, but it's a negative start to the sentence. It's a qualifier that will apply.
It will be a piece of adversity and an obstacle for them to overcome later in their career.
Right. Yeah. It will be, like, at the best case scenario is that this becomes the starting point of the lore, because it's so wild to lose consecutive Stanley Cup finals.
Yeah.
We haven't seen it in a generation.
Yeah.
And that's what's on the table tonight. How can you look away? This is unbelievable stuff.
It really is. And then, of course, on the other side, you know, we mentioned this yesterday, I'm very curious to see if Florida can find that killer instinct. And I think the opposing force on the other side is going to be, what level does, and I'm not even going to throw Dreisaitl in here, and that's no disrespect to Dreisaitl, but, like, for me, it really is, what level does McDavid get to tonight? We all know what he's capable of, and there's no runway. There's no, well, we'll see what he does in the next game, right? Like, it is time for him to, as you said, play 30 minutes and do whatever is humanly possible for him to extend this series. That's kind of where I'm leaning. Like, if I had to bet right now, I might bet on a game seven in Edmonton later on this week, just because I'm hard-pressed to imagine that Florida avoids McDavid just dominating a game and single-handedly taking it over and winning it in this series, and he hasn't really done that yet. But those are kind of the two opposing narratives, opposing forces I'm watching tonight. On the one hand, has Florida kind of learned its lessons about closing teams out when they get their first chance? Can they do that tonight? And then what kind of otherworldly performance can McDavid pull out here with his back against the wall and try to extend the series?
Yeah, and the McDavid part of this is interesting. Like, so he's played 94 minutes and 55 seconds in the first five games of the series, the 5-on-5, Jamie. Shots are 61-42, okay?
Yeah.
For the Oilers in those minutes. However, scoring chances per natural stat trick, 46 for the Oilers, 50 against.
Wow.
And actual goals, 3-6 for, like, with Florida leading. So that's 3-6 from Edmonton's perspective. You know, I mean, honestly, if you'd told me that the Oilers were going to be outscored by 3 in McDavid's 5-on-5 minutes through the first five games of the series, I'd have said, well, that must have been a nice five-game series.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like,
to be fair, it was extraordinarily close to being so. Right? Like,
100%.
The three-goal comeback, I mean, it could have been exactly the story you just laid out. Like, wow, Florida really mopped the floor with them.
And not to mention their comeback in game one.
Yep.
You know, I mean, they've been hanging on in this series, and they need to punch back here. Like, they need to punch back, and they need to win those minutes at the top of the lineup, period. So, yeah, I mean, again, I don't want to ladle extra stress on literally the best hockey-playing human I've ever seen play the sport. Not that he's listening, but
he's in his stall in Florida. He's like, God damn, Drance, why are you doing this to me?
I just don't want to set this up like the old Stephen A. Smith, like, McFraud can't win the big one. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not doing that. That's not the conversation we should be having about a player this incredible who's actually been great in this series. I mean, he has 7 points in 5 games. Like, we're not doing this. I'm not down this blame McDavid road. It's just that for the Oilers to take over.
Yeah, like, it's not. That's their path to victory.
Correct.
That's it.
It's not a moral failing if you can't do it or pull it off. It's not a performance failing either, to be totally honest with you. Mm-hmm. It's just that if the Oilers are going to win Game 6 and if they're going to win Game 7 and if they're going to lift the Stanley Cup and end Canada's long championship drought in the NHL, McDavid's going to have to take this over.
Yeah, it feels like that for sure. And this text came in. Let's be real. When the Oilers aren't getting blown out, they're trying to come back. They're clearly the second best team. And he says, at this point, I can't see why Florida won't be back next year. Well, four cups in a row is awfully challenging, but possibly the Oilers too. But it's time to build a really strong team around McDavid and Draisaitl. And I think that gets to what you were saying about just this feeling that the margins are so fine for Edmonton, and it feels like this series could have been over already in Florida's favor. And yet, having said that, and I think the texter's right about, you know, Florida's clearly been the better team through five games, I still have a real difficulty just writing off the Oilers because there is always that threat of the McDavid supernova game, and who knows if we end up seeing it tonight.
I also think we shouldn't overstate the extent to which the Panthers have been the better team. They've definitely led for more, way more in this series. And obviously the Oilers have come unglued in a game and in a way that the Panthers haven't at any point in game three. But, you know, the truth is, too, is like overall goals at 5-on-5, 13 for Florida, 9 for the Oilers. And that's with the Oilers converting on 6.9% of their shots and the Panthers converting on close to 11%, 10.7. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, they're converting on 5% more of their shots and have only outscored them by 4 at 5-on-5. Like, this has not been a knockout, despite the way that these games have gone with the Panthers scoring first and on. Like, that, this has not been a wipeout series that the Oilers are fortunate to be hanging around in. Truly, it hasn't. Like, the Oilers have held their own and actually stressed the Panthers out in large swaths of this game. In fact, I would frame this like, I think the texter is getting to something true, which is that the Panthers have the highest gear in the league, including a higher gear than the Edmonton Oilers. But I think both teams pose issues for the other that neither team can actually solve, right? And obviously with Florida, it's their forecheck. You know, as much as Edmonton upgraded their puck moving, they're getting stuck in their own end. They're getting cut off the stem. And they're spending way too much time, especially in some of those second periods, just like barely doing anything other than getting the puck out of their end of the ice and then having the Panthers bullet train their way back in at a million miles per hour on a regroup. So that's happening for Edmonton for sure. But there's also moments where Edmonton gets going off the rush or starts generating. And, you know, in those moments, which we definitely didn't see in game five, which was the Panthers' most complete defensive effort of the series, the Panthers don't have an answer for them, right? Like, the Panthers fundamentally have been widely outshot with McDavid on the ice. And if McDavid gets out on the ice against someone who's not Gustav Forsling and Sasha Barkov, he's winning that matchup. He's winning those minutes. Those are very dangerous. In fact, he's probably been deeply unfortunate to not make more hay out of those minutes. So, you know, it's an interesting dynamic here, just because, Florida's the deeper team. I think they have the slightly higher gear, but I think both teams, you know, I don't think either team is better than the other one in truth. I think both teams pose issues for the other that neither side has the answer for. And so it's like two juggernauts trading haymakers. And the question is, it's just going to come down to which sort of lands the decisive blow in the right moment, which is, you know, not to channel Rick talking too much.
I take your point about looking at the underlying numbers and the evenness, but to extend the boxing metaphor there, like, Florida has landed knockout blows, you know what I mean, to end a round here, right? Like, they've had the two clear victories in this series and Edmonton hasn't. They've had to have the big comeback in game one.
Sure.
So that colors people's perception of it, right?
But they've also coughed up three third period leads.
Sure, but you can look at the three-goal comeback either way, right? On the one hand, you'd be like, oh, Florida choked that away. How could they not have finished it off? But, like, that's an incredible comeback from Edmonton. You know what I mean? They get credit for that, too. It's not a demerit on their record. You still pulled off the amazing comeback.
No, but you have to look at the comeback, I think, as being instructive. You have to look at the Corey Perry goal that tied game two as instructive. You have to look at the push that the Oilers put on in game one as instructive. Like, there are moments where this, you know, incredible Panthers defensive team, right, truly, like, that's their calling card, have been unable to do to the Oilers what they've done to everyone else and just sort of smother them, right? Like, they're as well as they've played, in moments you've seen this Oilers team be consistently able to find ways to manufacture stuff and offense. And, you know, like, there's a ton of moments, even in the blowout games, where the game absolutely can go a different way, if not for like a post here or a post there. I mean, think about how many times you've seen McDavid hit a post in this series, yeah, right? As much as we're like, well, in these key moments, the Panthers have had this huge edge. I don't know, man. Like, the Oilers feel like they're sort of on an unsustainable run too, of poor finishing luck here, or of just not quite getting it done. A lot of what they've tried just hasn't quite worked. So, you know, that to me, that's kind of unsustainable too. Like, there's, I think you're ignoring how dangerous Edmonton has still been to the Panthers at your own risk. And I understand why it's easy or tempting to land there, just given how these games have felt with the Panthers always in the lead. But that's, you know, there's at least an element of random distribution in that, in addition to like reflecting overall team quality and the gap between these two.
Quickly, if the series ends tonight, Florida wins, Sam Bennett, Conn Smythe, or is Brad Marchand a possibility? Is it close enough that it depends on who does what tonight?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so voting for the Conn Smythe, for the anyone interested in gambling on it, is done after the, I think it's 10 minutes to go in the third.
Yes.
I recall. I voted for the Conn Smythe in 2020. So I've been an awards voter. I haven't been a consistent awards voter because I'm not a national reporter. I'm not always on the series. Sam Bennett is the favorite, but it's not by that much. He actually closed game five, Sam Bennett, as a minus 270 favorite, which quickly became minus 200 because Brad Marchand's odds kept shooting up. Mm-hmm. And now he's minus 140. So his odds keep dropping because Brad Marchand, now you can buy him at plus 310. By the way, the Oilers are plus 300 to win the Stanley Cup right now. Okay, so you get 3-1 if you want to bet on an Oilers win in back-to-back games as opposed to betting it game by game, which, you know, you could also do. But the real way to play it, Jamie,
is Connor McDavid, Conn Smythe.
Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, double tap them for Conn Smythe at 7-1.
Yes,
if you think
go.
The Oilers, if you want to bet the Oilers to come back and win the Cup, that's the play.
I like it. I think it's going to be Sam Bennett, barring like a absolute signature Brad Marchand performance where it's like two goals, including the winner or something, which could absolutely happen. Of course, I'm not writing it off. I think Sam Bennett's going to take it if Florida gets it done tonight. And just another
piece. Don't ignore that the media people just want to talk to Brad. Like, who would you rather have at the podium? Who would you rather have at the podium in, you know, impacting your story that night? Like, you know, Brad Marchand's going to like vamp.
You're right. That's going to be a legendary availability. That's a that's a good bit of inside baseball.
Do you want to work hard tonight, or do you want to quickly throw a bunch of Brad Marchand quotes in your story and go have a beer?
Yeah.
It shouldn't impact the voting, but it might.
That's a very interesting one. Speaking of hockey, it's never too early to get your Vancouver Giants season tickets. Tickets start at under $19 at vancouvergiants.com/season tickets. We'll take a break. We haven't even gotten into the Calder Cup final, which, of course, game three goes in Abbotsford tonight. So we'll dive into that. Possibility of a lineup change for Abbotsford as well. We'll do that. We'll take your text next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Jantz here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. I want to remind everyone again that the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50-50 is live right now. You could win half the jackpot. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, a program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10. You can get bundles for even more chances to win as well. Don't wait. Go get your tickets now. JaysCareGolf.RaffleNexus.com, or you can text MONEY to 650-650 now. Get the link sent directly to you that way. Again, jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com. And as a reminder, once that jackpot gets up to $15,000, we here at Sportsnet 650 are going to give away a signed Vancouver Canucks Quinn Hughes jersey. So let's make that a reality. We're desperate to give away, to give it away. Help us do it. Help us get that jackpot up to $15,000. Must be 19 or older and live in BC to play. Let's make a big impact together. All right. As mentioned, game three of the Calder Cup final goes tonight in Abbotsford. It is the first opportunity for the Abbotsford Canucks to host a Calder Cup playoff game. In fact, they've got three this week, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, because of the travel involved east to west coast. The Calder Cup goes 2-3-2. So they'll get all three home games in as a result of the split in Charlotte. We'll see. Hey, if they win three in a row, they'll be able to claim the Calder Cup in Abbotsford. Game time's at 7. Brandon Astle and Landon Ferraro have the call. We're going to chat with Landon Ferraro in just about half an hour here on the show. And, of course, you'll be able to hear the game here on Sportsnet 650. So a lot to be excited about. I see they're selling standing room tickets for the Abbotsford Center, so you know the crowd is going to be fired up. You know it's going to be a fantastic environment in there for this Calder Cup game. I mean, first and foremost, Trance, the story from the two games in Charlotte was, yeah, it was a split, and both games went to overtime, but the shot counter was overwhelmingly in favor of the Charlotte Checkers. And so I think job number one is returning home. How can Manny Malhotra and his team find a way, not necessarily to turn the tables and dominate like Charlotte was able to, but at least even things up and have it closer to be a 50-50 territorial split than it was in Charlotte, where it was overwhelmingly against them?
Yeah, and I mean, I thought the balance of play reflected that. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Watching those games back, I thought the Abbotsford Canucks, you know, look, credit to them, right? They were disciplined. They were opportunistic with their chances. Artur Shelovs continues to be a huge story in this Calder Cup playoffs with, you know, significant ramifications in terms of, you know, what that should mean, what that does mean for this club. But man, you know, Charlotte has a higher gear. Like Charlotte had a higher gear anyway in those first two games. And I think Abbotsford was pretty fortunate to come out with a win, with a split on the road. But that said, like, this is the playoffs, right? Like, this is a playoff series. We see momentum shift all the time. And earning a split on the road against a team that, you know, barely needed any games to get through the Eastern Conference part of this Calder Cup final bracket is incredible, right? I mean, the Abbotsford Canucks arrived in this series as betting underdogs, right? Plus 100. And they earned a split on the road. And man, that's good work done. Now you've got the home crowd. You've had a couple games. Maybe you caught them a little bit off guard in terms of what this club was capable of. There's going to be no surprises now that the series shifts back to Abbotsford, and a huge opportunity awaits. I mean, if you can keep them on their heels, if you can find a way to, you know, like, just hold your own. You don't you don't need to outshoot them like they outshot you, but you need it to be an awful lot closer, I think, if you're going to pull off, you know, sort of winning three of the next five and being champions. Something, by the way, which no Canucks American League affiliate has ever done. I mean, this is a tremendous opportunity for this franchise.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I think the atmosphere is going to be fantastic. And as you said, look, as the farther you get into the season, like, process always matters, but results are king at this time, right? So the process, whatever the process was in those first two games, you can almost throw it out because, hey, the result was a split on the road, which is all anyone would want in that situation. All you could possibly ask for is getting the split. And the beauty of it is now you have the chance to reset and try to correct the process. But it's much different at this time, the way I think we focus on the process versus results thing. Like, it is all about just find a way to win, find a way to do whatever you actually have, whatever you possibly can to get that win and get that result. And they were able to do it at least once in Charlotte. Now, one interesting wrinkle tonight to watch is going to be whether Jonathan Lekker-Mackey draws back into the lineup. And I know Rick Dhaliwal, who's going to join us tomorrow for the crossover on his show, Donnie and Dolly, earlier today said, quote, don't be surprised if Lekker-Mackey gets back in. Usually when I hear Rick Dhaliwal use the don't be surprised language,
that's Dhaliwal for he's in.
Yeah. Like, I don't think Rick's just speculating. I think he's probably heard something along those lines. So I would in fact now be very surprised if he wasn't in the lineup, but it's a fascinating situation for the player. And I know you have said, and we've talked about on the show, like, don't get too far down the negative road on the fact that Lekker-Mackey hasn't been a star in these playoffs and that he has come out of the lineup, right? There are reasons that it might not be that big of a deal considering his age and the rigors of going through his first full professional North American season and all that. I'm just fascinated by the decision to bring him back in if they do and the opportunity he has in front of him now, right? With, hey, you've got a little bit of rest. You've been out of the lineup. If he does indeed come back in, we've already gone through all these different waves of like Lekker-Mackey hype and conversation throughout the course of this season, right? When he was lighting it up early in the American League.
Since he was drafted.
Yeah, really, since he was drafted. And then the incredibly disappointing year, the rebound year, the performance at Abbotsford early this year, some great moments at the NHL level, then gets sent back down. Like, there's been a huge ups and downs. I mean, talk about finishing with an exclamation point. If you come back into the lineup with max five games left in your team's season and are able to be a difference maker and someone who moves the needle.
I do think it's important, though, to note, Jamie, that I feel like we, on this program, editorially speaking, like, always left the light on for him, even when we were outlining how concerning it was based on historical comparables. But, you know, he did such special things as a 17-year-old that season from hell where he had mono and concussion issues, like three separate injuries, that just absolute nightmare draft plus one campaign. I don't think we overreacted to it. You know, we were suitably impressed, as we should have been, by his dominance at the Allsvenskan level the next season. And I think we've been, you know, like we've been pretty, generally speaking, I don't think we've overreacted to the fact that he struggled to this extent, nor did we anoint him as the next Mike Ball.
Yes. Nor were we like, he's slide him in, you know, get Besser out of here. You've got Lekker-Mackey, and therefore, you know what I mean? There was never that conversation either for us.
Totally. The conversation has maybe been, could he be your Matthew Coronado next year? Right? And the answer is maybe, but man, he's going to have to put on a lot of weight, and he's going to have to figure out how to be a lot faster. Like, he's going to need to add a step. He's going to need to do all that classic young player stuff that you need to go from being a talented young guy to being an NHL player, right? I mean, there's a reason we obsess over NHL hockey and pay to watch it, right? It's not that it's easy.
Nope.
It's not that these guys are good. These guys are amazing, right? Like, that's the point. And so, anyway, I mean, big opportunity for Lekker-Mackey. I guess I'm defensive about the conversation, I want to use the term like open my drawers here, but just to like sort of
peel back the curtain. How about that?
Well, that's dirty. What's that smut? Peel back the curtain. Why do you peel a curtain? What sort of curtain is this?
Go on.
Yes. Sorry. Before I say something I regret.
Yeah.
I'm always a little annoyed when a conversation like this centers on a somewhat undersized, right? Like, still physically developing young player, especially when they're European, but it also applies to North American players too, right? I mean, like the Zach conversation drives me up the wall. Now, size matters in hockey. I mean, I'm not denying that, right? I do think that smaller players can be systematically undervalued. I also don't think Lekker-Mackey's like that small. We're not talking about, you know, a true pint-sized type forward, but we are talking about a guy who's sub 6 foot. We are talking about a guy who's sub 200 pounds. And I don't think there's anything about his game that like is going to lend itself to struggling in the playoffs over the long haul, right? Like, that's not who I mean, you've seen him dominate his peers in huge games at the U20 level and the U18 level and in the Swedish professional hockey playoffs and on and on. And so I just get annoyed in sometimes, like, these conversations are framed like, we already know that he's just like Pettersson and can't get it done in the playoffs, ignoring that Pettersson has had two playoff runs, one of which was electric, right? One of which was very bad. So anyway, those conversations annoy me. I'm like pre-annoyed by the Lekaramäki debate. And it's just like, this guy's not at a level in terms of his physical development, right? Where you should have expected him, I think, reasonably, to be a star-level performer playing, 25 more professional games at a higher level than he's ever been at, right, in his career. Like, yeah, he ran out of steam. Shocking. He's going to need years in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Years in the gym to be the guy he needs to be in terms of the cutbacks, in terms of protecting the puck along the wall, in terms of having the first step required to attack with speed at the NHL level. Like, we knew this, or we should have known this. I felt like I knew it. I don't want tonight to be a referendum on this guy's ability to play in big games. There's a lot of road to run here. But, I mean, Abbotsford needs a spark. They need some creativity. They need some east-west attacking. They need some puck possession. He can help in all those areas. So it'll be fascinating to see how he performs.
Yeah, the way I look at it is, you always want more data on the player, right? And more games at the AHL level. And the AHL level production can be, it's not writing in stone your fate, right? It doesn't decide your fate, but it can tell you a lot about what the player might turn out to be. So you always are going to be paying attention to what they're doing at the AHL level. You want the sample size to be as big as possible and all that. And when he's getting extra games and he's not producing, I understand the consternation. To me, it's never been like it's because he's not a playoff player thing. You know what I mean? That's where I kind of draw the line at the conversation. To me, this Calder Cup playoff experience for Lekkerimäki tells us very, very little, if not nothing, about what he's going to look like as a contributor in the Stanley Cup playoffs, in 6 years, which is really what we're talking about. What is he?
Right.
He's 20 years old. He's 21. Like, you're hoping that in 5 or 6 years, he can be a prime player for you on a Stanley Cup contending team. And his game and his body, his physical attributes are going to look completely different at that stage than they do now. So, like, to me, the playoff thing, whatever, it's the sample size of AHL games that we should be looking at. And that includes when he was very successful and very productive at that level earlier in the season. Go ahead.
Sorry, just the other thing to keep in mind. This guy is 5 years younger than Linus Karlsson.
Yeah.
He's 4 years younger than Baines and Sisson.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep that in mind. Like, oh, he's not as ready to compete in, his 70th professional game of the year at the hardest time of year against men 5 to 10 years younger than him, older than him. Like, yeah, shocking, right? Like, this is not it's a mark of how dominant he was in the American League this season that this can even be a disappointment.
Mm.
Right? Like, it's a positive that we're even having this conversation. And I just think that's a really important thing to keep front of mind. And I just want to make sure that no one's overfitting the sort of classic playoff, narrative, especially given the context of it feeling like familiar and of him being Swedish, clamoring in our market to see the Canucks get bigger and to add Canadian players, the contrast with how the Florida Panthers play. And, some of that's fair, right? Like, there's real discussions to be had about sort of the makeup of what a winning hockey team looks like and what the Canucks need to become a winning hockey team. I'm not sort of arguing against that either. Just be careful about how you apply it or overfit that narrative to apply to a 20-year-old who still had a remarkable first professional season in North America, regardless of how tonight goes and regardless of whether or not he makes another impact, scores another goal, even has another promising moment the American League playoffs this year.
And, thinking about Lekkerimäki and his immediate future with the Canucks beyond this series, right? And how he figures into the organization's plans next year. And, building on what we were saying there, like the whole idea of, well, just plug him in the top six. I don't think that's fair to the player. I don't think that's realistic. I think that is severely undervaluing what someone like Brock Besser has been bringing to the franchise for a lot of years. But, and, partly this was sparked by reading your piece at The Athletic today, looking at the free agency cases for Brock Besser and Pugh Suter and kind of acknowledging, hey, there's a very, very good chance that both of these guys will be playing elsewhere come next season. And one of the big domino effects of that is going to be all of a sudden the Canucks power play, which has felt extremely, extremely familiar for what, the last four or five seasons, with the midseason departure of JT Miller. And now if Brock Besser goes, you're going to be looking at basically two core pieces of the power play left, Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson. And man, we all know how much Elias Pettersson has struggled on the power play and how much of a significant part of his struggles that has been. So for the first time in a while, this Canucks power play is really going to need, I don't know if reimagining is the right word, but it's going to need to be completely reconstructed, basically, around Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson. And obviously you hope that the guys they get to fill in, you know, hey, we need our number two center and another star forward, you hope that they're going to be big parts of the answer on the power play. But I also start to think, you know, like if they don't get the true needle movers in their top six, if they are not, maybe they're, you know, more play drivers, but not necessarily power play aces. And you're still looking at this and saying like, oh, man, I don't love what this offense is going to be for the Canucks. They're going to need to find a way to squeeze every last drop they can out of the power play to try to float their overall team offense. And I start to wonder, like, is there going to be room on this roster, in this lineup, for more of a power play specialist who maybe is in your bottom six but can be on your first unit, just because there's not a lot of obvious options right now on the team? And I think that could be a really potentially interesting role for Jonathan Lekker-Mackey. Rick Dhaliwal again brought up Andre Kuzmenko, who's a UFA, a possible reunion there. And, you know, my initial reaction was to laugh, but then I kind of thought about it. I was like, depending on the term, if you got him as a bottom six guy who was also a power play specialist, a power play ace for you, like, I actually do think that is kind of a sneaky position of need for the Canucks. And whether it's an in-house solution like Lekker-Mackey, whether they go out into the free agency market to look for it, they need to find credible extra options on the power play. Because as you look at it right now, like, it is very, very slim pickings to fill out the man advantage unit.
Yeah, and I mean, that was something they needed last summer too, right? I mean, they needed Daniel Sprong to hit, and he didn't.
Yeah.
At all.
Yep.
So, yeah, you design a first unit right now. We're talking what? Pettersson,
Hughes,
obviously.
DeBrusk.
We're talking DeBrusk.
Yeah.
We're talking Garland, probably. And then what?
Filipino?
We talk in Dakota Joshua at the net front. We give Linus Karlsson a chance.
Yeah.
We hoping for Jonathan Lekker-Mackey.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it's, and now again, like, they want to add two forwards. So you hope the forwards have some power play utility. But if it's, you know, Marco Rossi and Pavel Zacha, and like that's on the high end of what they might hope to acquire, there's still going to be room for some power play specialist in there. You know what I mean?
Oh, well, I mean, Pavel Zacha, you know, the power play is not his bread and butter.
This is what I'm talking about. This is what I'm saying, right? Like, you could get credible solutions to your top six problems.
One of them.
Yeah. And not address the power play issues and still need to address what you're doing on the power play.
Yeah. And this is sort of where it's sort of interesting and easy for us to say, well, they need two top six forwards. Okay. And then it's like, well, what positions do they play? Ideally, well, they're both centers, but at least one of them has to be a top two line center. Okay. But really, they also need a right-handed centerman who win draws, right? And maybe it's Atu Ratu because, you know, Landon likes to do shots with his buddies while Shorty talks about his reverse take based on, right? But Atu Ratu is not right-handed, and while he's excellent in the circle, you know, that's probably insufficient. You probably want another guy. You probably want a righty to win some draws and to be a mainstay on the penalty kill. You definitely need to replace Brock Besser. I mean, you've lost Brock Besser and JT Miller and Bo Horvat across the last 30 months, 24 months. You know, not to mention Elias Lindholm, who was a really good fit, actually, for the on the power play.
Well, not
during his brief stint here.
Not to mention Andre Kuzmenko, who was an ace on the power play for the team.
Kuzmenko scored a million power play goals, you know, acting as Elias Pettersson's backboard on the back door there. And so, yeah, I mean, you need a net front guy. Like, you need a net front guy who can be as productive. Because if we're being totally honest, you know, when the Canucks power play first showed signs of being a well above average or top 10 unit. It was Besser, Pettersson, and Hughes up high. You had Horvat in the bumper where he eventually became an absolute monster, although he wasn't at the outset, and JT Miller at the net. And then Miller ends up sort of bumping out. They acquire Toffoli. Then you had Toffoli at the net front. You sort of had that era. And then you had Brock Besser familiarizing himself with the net front, but not really reaching the apex of his powers. And Kuzmenko coming in and going absolutely nuke in that spot, convincing Vancouver Canucks fans that he was a fan. Or sorry, not that he was a fan. Convincing Vancouver Canucks fans that he was some star player for whom it's ridiculous that they should have ever considered trading him for a second. Right, I mean, that's how good he was. He had this market completely fooled. And, you know, and then, not me, but everyone else. And then you got this sort of apex version of Besser where he'd sort of become this nasty screener. I mean, Besser's deflection goals, how many deflection goals did he score over the course of the last 2 years? Just these sort of greasy goals off. And how many times did he set the screen? Was it him not getting a point on the JT Miller wrist shot?
But he
goal.
Was perfectly, you know, right
was
in front
with
of the
Miller,
goalie.
They had great chemistry.
Yep.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, exactly. He was perfectly right in front of the goalie for that JT Miller play, which was their best power play.
And Miller was so good
at
manipulating that traffic, and Besser knew exactly where to stand. Like, you know, not that we need to like wax poetic and invite all the "they traded the wrong guys" people to sort of text in, but I mean, there was work done between Miller and Besser, right? Like, Besser will credit Miller at length for helping him develop that skill, right? It's one of the reasons, like, I know, you know, Dom Lecision wrote a piece at The Athletic, and you know how I weight Dom Lecision's work, about the Besser extension being really risky. And it is, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I or not the Besser extension. Whoever signs Besser to his fourth contract is going to be taking a big risk in terms of, you know, the term on the deal and the cost of it. But when you're as good on the power play and as malleable on the power play as he is, and when you've developed the sorts of, for lack of a better word, like old man game that Besser has, right? It, like the way that he wins at the net front now, the deflections, the work in traffic, how he navigates traffic, how he's able to manipulate traffic with his shot, right? I mean, those are the... Like, think about an outlier forward who's maintained their effectiveness into even their 40s in Corey's case. And there's like, what do Perry and Pavelski and every other outlier guy who's remained effective for way longer than the age curves say they should? What do they all have in common? Like, where do they win? Where do they get their goals? What attributes set them apart? I mean, Besser has that. And he didn't always. He was not the biggest frame. He's not a power forward classically. He didn't enter the league as that guy. He's become that guy. And it's one of the main reasons why, you know, I sort of look askance at the math, you know, doing what everyone else does to me and being like, nerds, when people are like, well, Besser's a really risky deal. Like, that's going to be a tough one for other. It's like, I don't know. If you're as adaptable as he's proven to be, if you can, you know, find a way to completely change your stripes at the NHL level in your 20s. I mean, you've at least got that shot to at least be a specialist who maintains an uncanny level of effectiveness for longer than the math suggests you probably will.
Yeah, and we'll see how that influences which teams are in the bidding for Brock Besser and what he's ultimately able to get on the open market when July 1st rolls around. We'll take a quick break here. Landon Ferraro joins us next. He's going to be on the scene in Abbotsford tonight on the call with Brandon Astle as the Abbotsford Canucks host the Charlotte Checkers in Game 3 of the Calder Cup Finals. We'll get his thoughts on that series, maybe a little Stanley Cup Final in there as well, next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. It's never too early to get your Vancouver Giants season's tickets. Tickets start at under $19 at vancouvergiants.com/season tickets. As mentioned, game three of the Calder Cup Finals tonight in Abbotsford. Dan and Sat are going to be on location at a Boston Pizza in Abbotsford for Canucks Central. So we're pulling out all the stops. They're going to Abbotsford. Brandon Astle and Landon Ferraro are going to be there at the Abbotsford Center as well to have this one covered. And we'll see if the Abbey Canucks can take a 2-1 series lead over the Charlotte Checkers in the Calder Cup Final. And 7 o'clock puck drop on that one. I believe we're going to start with the Stanley Cup Final game tonight here on the station and then transfer to the Calder Cup game in its entirety. So wall-to-wall playoff hockey action coming up here on Sportsnet 650 this evening. And, of course, also, if you weren't able to get tickets tonight to Abbotsford, they're hosting games on Thursday and Saturday this week as well. So games 4 and 5 also in Abbotsford this week for your chance to get tickets. All right, guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. And joining us now on the Power West hotline, former NHL player, contributor here on Sportsnet 650, and he'll be on the call for the Abbey game tonight. He is Landon Ferraro. Landon, thanks as always, man. How are you?
Doing good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. I'm excited about all of the big game hockey on tonight between the Stanley Cup and the Calder Cup. And let's start in Abbotsford. As mentioned, you're going to be doing the game tonight. You were in Charlotte for the first two games as well. And I think really the big theme from those first two games was obviously Abbey will be thrilled to get a split. Anytime you go on the road for two games in a playoff series, you get a split. That's very good news. But we also saw what the shot counter looked like, what the shot clock looked like, and it was heavily tilted in favor of Charlotte. What does Abbey need to do to even that up and make it more of an even territorial battle starting tonight in Game 3?
Well, I'd say the most important thing is having a good start. The only period through all of them that Abbotsford really had a good start was the third period of Game 1. And past that, like, Charlotte is a very fast, very aggressive team, much how the Florida Panthers play. Their D love coming down the walls, pinching in the offensive zone, and it's caused a lot of trouble. But at the same time, Abbotsford's done a really good job of, you know, like, the shot disparity is massive. It's, I believe, 96 to 44, something close to that. But they've done a good job of forcing plays to the outside, so there's been a lot of shots from some bad angles, and then, you know, the defenseman doing a really good job in front of clearing out the lanes, so Shelovs has been able to see. So, you know, Charlotte clearly wants volume. Abbotsford is trying to find, obviously, some more ways to get to the net, but at the same point, even last game, they only have 13 shots, but Willannon hits two posts in the third. Sasson hits one on the power play early in the first overtime period. Like, they have their chances. They just couldn't convert.
You talk about the starts for Abbotsford, and even not just necessarily the starts at the beginning of a game, but the start of a period. And, you know, that's been a theme, of course, in the Stanley Cup Final as well, with Edmonton having slow starts in the first period. What goes into making a team either a strong starting team or a slow starting team, and how can you correct that kind of mid-playoff series?
Well, it's an interesting question, especially for the American League. You know, like, when we're talking the Stanley Cup playoffs, that's, you know, Edmonton, you know, in a lot of ways looks like, you know, with the year that they've had, you know, so many guys going in and out, especially late in the season, of missing time with injury, plugging people around. They didn't have, you know, depth scoring was a real issue for them. There's guys having to play big minutes through long stretches. Like, it looks like they've gotten tired a bit. But for the American League, there's a couple different factors that go into it. One, Abbotsford has played a handful of games more because they had to play the play-in series. Their series have gone later, deeper into each round as well, where Charlotte, you know, they swept the last two series and didn't have a play-in. So, you know, they've played less games, but the biggest part of it is neither of these teams had seen each other. They've never played each other until game one of the Calder Cup final. So you're going into a, you know, a visiting building where their team is fast, aggressive. They've been sitting there for 6 days getting ready for the finals. It was, you know, they were locked and ready to go. And, you know, as the two games went along, you could see more and more points where Abbotsford started to kind of punch holes in the forecheck and through the neutral zone to be able to start playing a bit more of their game. But, you know, the biggest thing is it's the fans. Like, it's the atmosphere down there. It was extremely loud. They had their first two sellouts ever in the Bojangles Coliseum. Find a way to say that name as much as you can, because it's just fun. But, you know, they come back to Abbotsford tonight, and this fan group has been amazing through their playoff run. I imagine just being back home, having that support, having that, you know, kind of pressure cooker that builds up in, you know, in a bit of a tighter rink, it should be something that allows them to have a bit more energy, especially early in period one.
What have you made of sort of Baines stepping up in the conference final? You've had Linus Karlsson, probably their most dangerous player throughout this playoff, and then obviously Max Sisson coming up big. You've got this sort of trio of guys knocking on the door at the NHL level who've all stepped up their game. What does that mean, do you think, for the organization and for what training camp looks like in the fall?
Well, it just creates more competition, and not only that, but as the Canucks, who, you know, it's no secret, have a very big summer ahead of them, and they're trying to retool, especially their forward group. You know, now have some young players that are on, you know, either entry level or lower money deals, that if you can find ways for them to force their way into the lineup, you're just opening up cap space to put elsewhere. So, you know, like the experience of going through here, through going through this playoff run and doing well, being able to play big at big moments, like that's just more votes of confidence to the management group that's watching that, okay, maybe these guys are ready to take steps. And, you know, like Karlsson specifically, he, you know, he's been so good through this playoffs run, but, you know, the last two games of the conference final and the first couple through the finals, he's just been okay. He started to look a little better. He scored a really nice goal on the power play in game two, where it looks like he's going to start to, you know, make his push, and they're going to need him to be a big player. And that type of pressure in these circumstances, like, that hardens a player, makes him more ready to make that jump, because as things get tough for him at the NHL level, you know, even though it's the American League, like, you can still lean back on this experience and see the ups and downs and how you got yourself back rolling and moving that way. So again, like, it just all around, it's a big boost for themselves and the organization just looking into summer and into next season.
And we've talked a lot on this program about Kirill Kudryavtsev. In some ways, the guy who profiles is the most classic young player breaking out in their first North American professional season that the Abbotsford Canucks have, that's playing a major role for them on this playoff run. But the profile's so rare. There just aren't a lot of non-power play one guys, sub-6-foot, left-handed shooters who end up carving out a significant NHL niche. You know, Matt Greslick and Sam Girard being sort of the exceptions to the rule. Relatively few and far between. What do you make of Kudryavtsev? Because it's a very odd profile, but clearly he's been an incredibly effective contributor for this Abbotsford team.
He really has. And to me, the two most important things that are letting him play to the level that he is his patience with the puck, whether it's in the offensive zone or, more importantly, to the defensive zone. Like, he's able to accept a forecheck, get the guy on his hip, and still be able to make that first play. He's able, his stick is extremely, extremely good, especially in the D zone. He can, you know, angle guys well and use, because he's not an overly big guy, but he's able to, you poke the stick in right at the right time to get it off. And then he's able to, because he's a good skater as well, get himself in front, and now all of a sudden he has the puck again. You know, he doesn't have a point in game two, but he had 5 assists in the 5 games prior. And a lot of those have come from him getting a puck, like causing a turnover in the defensive zone, getting it and not thinking twice, but just starting to skate. He's led the rush a couple times, thrown it out to one of the wingers and drove through. Like, he gets himself involved that way as well. Not that I would imagine that he's going to be a big point guy if he finds a way into the NHL, but at the same time, he uses the tools that are available to him, and he's really excelled, especially, it being his first season over here. He's obviously turned a lot of eyes, and rightfully so.
Landon, a lot of talk through this run about Jonathan Lekkermäki, in and out of the lineup, not producing the same way he has he did for Abbotsford in the regular season. Now, we'll see what ultimately happens with the lineup tonight. I know Rick Dhaliwal had the report that, he wouldn't be surprised if Lekkermäki gets back in tonight. From a coach's perspective, how do you weigh the decision? What factors are you weighing when you decide whether to keep Lekkermäki out tonight or bring him back in at this point of the series?
Well, I mean, with him specifically, it's, he's a, highly offensive, gifted player. And we've talked about this, at length before, but, he still is, he's still quite slight. He's not, the heaviest or strongest guy yet. And, he found ways around that through the season. But as it gets through the playoff run, like, you have to remember, with him coming from overseas, like, this is the first year he's played 20 more regular season games, and now it's through a playoff run. Like, it's a lot for your body to handle, and he's trying to figure that out, and he's still working hard in the scratches, skates, trying to make sure he's ready. I imagine that he'll get in a game through this series, especially when you look at the travel, like the game tonight. It's a quick turnaround. They play Sunday. The travel day was yesterday, and it's a quick turnaround to game three. So he's sitting there a bit more fresh, clearly, excited to get a chance to help his team in the finals here. Like, it wouldn't be that far-fetched to think he gets in tonight as well. But, for him, it's just about trying to, you look at the other, you look at the opposition and how they play. Like I said at the beginning of our chat here, Charlotte, they play, they're not an overly big team. They have some really big guys, of course, a couple of them, but for the most part, it's a pretty average sized team. But in saying that, they're all a dog on a bone. They, as soon as the puck's turned over, they're not afraid to dive one guy in, another guy in, to try and cause a quick turnover and get back on the offensive side. So you have to be able to think the game fast, which, that's a check mark. Lekkermäki can do that, but on top of it, you got to be able to stand over a puck, be able to take some contact, hold on to it while still finding that next play, because you know that they're going to be coming extremely hard. So, I imagined that we'll see him in at some point, but it's still a learning process for him. You can't force him in the lineup just because you want to see him in there. But at the end of the day, he still has his hockey IQ, he still has his skill, and of course he has that very good release for his wrist shots. And he's someone that, while they're not getting a ton of shots right now, they might only get a shot or two at the net, but that's all he needs. If he gets a bit of space, he can finish, and that's something they clearly need some help with.
Yeah, and I wonder also, just to punch up the power play as well, right? Like, he can come back into the lineup, but you can still kind of protect his minutes, but also deploy him in those key situations where, as you say, like, you're looking for that one-shot scoring ability.
And especially with how, again, it doesn't just go with 5-on-5 and when they're on the power play that Charlotte's very aggressive. Even on the penalty kill, if the puck is on the yellow, if there's a bobble, they are coming at all times. And, Abbotsford's had some trouble with it, trying to get full control. They need to be able to use the bumper. Last game on Carlson's goal, it was really one of the first times that they got a player into the middle, which was Sammy Blais. Baines was able to touch it into him. He one-touched it down to the goal line, and all of a sudden Carlson had a clean look at a low drive and ends up scoring. Now, if you picture, you know, Lekkerbäcki in that middle spot where, again, he reads the play extremely well. He'll be able to help release some pressure, but also once you get him, once you get a bit more set, he can be that bumper player that you just need the one look for him to get open, and then he's taking, you know, a quick one-timer or a quick shot from the slot. Like, that's a look that, you know, if you can pick someone to have it, that's one guy you'd be throwing there, because more chances than not, he's going to find a way to put it in the net.
Landon, talking about the power play and sort of pivoting away from Abbotsford, how significant are the needs that the Canucks will have to replace on both sides of special teams in the what seems increasingly likely event that both Brock Besser and Pew Suter end up with new addresses on July 1st?
Well, I mean, unlucky, lucky for them. You know, as you're talking about the power play, it doesn't really change for what they're looking for at 5-on-5 as well of needs to replace. They need a shooter, whether that is Besser or it's someone else that they're bringing in. You know, they need that one-shot threat. They need someone that, even when the power play is not working quite like they want it to be, how it's moving around, that someone, you can get the puck to one guy and he's able to put that in. Like, you need that sharpshooter. Like, they're going to have to find someone that can fill that role. But, you know, more importantly, you know, with how the Canucks power play went this year, like, one of the biggest things is, like, you need guys that, of course, have the skill to make plays and put the puck in the net on the power play, but you need to be able to, one, enter the zone, and two, you need to be able to get the puck back. You know, that was one of the reasons Connor Garland, on top of injuries and everything like that, was so good for the Canucks this year, because whenever there's a dump in or a battle in the corner, he somehow finds his way into the mix, and he can get in and out of there with a puck. Like, you need those puck hounds. And, you know, that is a bit more of, you know, the new age game. You can't just be one or the other. You have to be able to work. You have to be able to battle and be okay with that and not shy away from it. So, you know, and I think it speaks to, as a whole, what the Canucks need. Of course, they need a center. They need a scoring winger. But at the same time, like, they need some guys that can go lean on someone. I'm not saying throw big hits or anything like that, but you need some guys that are able to get in there and battle.
Landon, just before we let you go, I know you're going to be locked in on Abby tonight, but I'm sure you'll be keeping one eye on the Stanley Cup Final Game 6 as well when you can. What's your gut telling you? Are we going to 7, or does Florida get it done tonight?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know about you guys, but I mean, for me, when Edmonton's had their back up against the wall over the past couple of years, but even more recently, like, they've been able to find that effort, been able to find a way to grit it out. But at the same point, that can only last for so long, that you are always battling back or able to muster up the ultimate effort to try and find a win. Florida seems that, you know, they've really found their groove. They're definitely okay with, you know, they're shutting it down. Like, it was an absolute masterclass last game of not really giving anything up, and especially the way that they lost the game before, giving up a 3-goal lead. You know, the Oilers need to find a way to get ahead and play with a lead a little bit, because you can't keep counting on comebacks. It's way too hard at this point of the year. I mean, if I had to say, I think Florida's going to be able to close it out tonight, but, you know, as you're saying that, there's, you know, a player in 97 and McDavid that has not had, you know, the series that he would have wanted for himself. And then you obviously have Dreisaitl as well. Like, if those two take over a game, which they, you know, they easily can, then you're looking at a game 7 again. But if I had to choose right now, I would really think that Florida is going to finish it out tonight.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too, where like my head says Florida gets it done, but I just can't knock the feeling that we might see one last spectacular effort from McDavid and Draisaitl to push it to Game 7. Landon, great stuff, man. Enjoy Abbotsford tonight. Should just be a fantastic scene on the ground at the Abbotsford Center for this one, and looking forward to hearing you on the call.
All right, thanks, guys. Have a good one.
That is Landon Ferraro, former NHL player, regular contributor on Sportsnet 650 and Sportsnet TV, and he will be on the call with Brandon Astle right here on the station for Game 3 of the Calder Cup Finals tonight in Abbotsford, so always looking forward to that. We'll take a quick break here. Lots to get into in the final segment. A new, very interesting top six forward option has popped up in the NHL rumor mill, at least from one reporter today, so we can get into that as a potential target for the Canucks. More connections between them and Buffalo from Frank Saravalli last night. Lots to get into. Keep your text coming in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment of Canucks Talk next here on Sportsnet 650. Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintex studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. It's never too early to get your Vancouver Giants season's tickets. Tickets start at under $19 at vancouvergiants.com/season tickets. So, of course, the theme of the Canucks offseason, well, I mean, a couple themes. One is obviously do whatever they can to keep Quinn Hughes happy. But the first action item under that part of the agenda is bolster the top six, right? Go out and acquire impact talent, ideally at center, but really impact talent of any description in the top six. And to that end, you know, we're all keeping a very close watch on different situations around the league, right? Oh, Marco Rossi all of a sudden bumps down to fourth line ice time in Minnesota in the playoffs. He seems to be very available. JJ Paterka in Buffalo maybe doesn't want to sign long term there. He could shake loose. Jason Robertson after the playoff exit in Dallas. And add another one to the list of targets to keep an eye on, keep track of here. Andy Strickland, who of course covers the St. Louis Blues, hosts the Cam and Strick podcast as well, or co-hosts, I should say. And, you know, beyond covering the Blues, pretty plugged in around the league, Andy Strickland tweeting earlier today, just about an hour ago in fact, here Troy Terry is available from Anaheim. Troy Terry, 27 years old, right shot right winger, pretty consistent, extremely consistent 20 goal scorer over the last several years, had that 37 goal season a few years ago where he really broke out. And also signed until 2030 at $7 million a season. Has a 10-team no-trade list. And so my initial gut reaction is...
Jamie, do me a quick favor.
Yeah.
Refresh the tweet.
Oh, is it gone now?
Browser. No, refresh the tweet and read the reply that he gave his own tweet.
Okay. Have I just... Has it really invalidated quick. the entire analysis I was about to do here?
Not yet, but just make sure for the purpose of the most accurate information getting to our dear listeners. Just quickly refresh it.
Team spokesperson reached out and says Terry is not available, so we'll see if anything comes out of it. Was told by an individual with a different team, and he also throws in another one. Also here, Jamie Benn will return to Dallas. So he put it out there. It's just unrelated to anything to do with Troy Terry, but there you go. Also here, Jamie Benn will return to Dallas. So he put it
out
there.
What a nails correction. It's like, I've been told this. I don't know if I believe it, but here's another scoop.
I've got another unrelated scoop to throw
absolute,
on top of this.
Like so non-derogatory. What a baller move. Yeah, so good.
Absolutely. So look, I mean, a team spokesperson reaching out and saying he's not available. it doesn't necessarily close the door on him potentially being available. It is the kind of thing that
no, it doesn't.
What I was going to say is my initial reaction is they should 100% be all over Troy Terry, the Canucks, that is, as should a lot of teams if Troy Terry is indeed on the market, if is indeed available. My second reaction, once I get over that part of it, is why on earth would Anaheim be out there shopping Troy Terry when they're trying desperately to take a big step forward in the standings this year? And so maybe that does line up with the second part of Andy Strickland's report, which is that a team spokesperson says he's not available, because it's like this, we've talked about this, right? Like, what are the situations where a player shakes loose? And so often it's either they're an RFA or they're extension eligible. And there's a big difference.
And
what?
There's one more.
What is it?
That applies to Anaheim.
What is it?
When a new coach comes into town.
All right.
And has a certain view of how he wants to play and a certain view of which players fit and which players might not among that group. And that's where Anaheim, like, because you're right. You're talking the structural business reasons why teams or organizations ultimately decide to re-roll and trade players specifically for mid-round draft capital.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's what we were talking about last week. But there's there's a million other reasons, but sort of two of the most pronounced are like the change of scenery trade or the coach don't like you trade.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that Joel Quenneville doesn't like Troy Terry. He hasn't worked with Troy Terry yet, right? If at most they've shaken hands and had a meeting.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's at most.
And maybe it went really poorly.
Yeah. No, but I think the substance, Strickland has already qualified his initial scoop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's fair for us to, you know, not like bury it, but to try and extract the substantive truth within, like, the nugget of truth within what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there is one, which is that Joel Quenneville is very set in his ways. The last time we saw him take over a team in Florida, a whole bunch of players previously thought completely untradeable ended up getting dealt. You know, that was Joel Quenneville was the coach when they did the, when they did the Trocheck trade, right? And when Quenneville was named head coach, that was unthinkable. Like, the idea of Vincent Trocheck being dealt by the Florida Panthers, he was like, you know, close personal relationship with ownership. I mean, he was Mr. Panther as far as, you know, anyone in the public could tell, and ended up getting dealt. And so I do think there's something interesting there in terms of exactly sort of what the Anaheim's priorities might be and which types of players Quenneville typically likes, which types of players sometimes get moved under Quenneville's watch. I think this applies to Trevor Zegras, right? I mean, one player type, like, here's another guy that was moved by the Florida Panthers who they declined to extend during Quenneville's relatively brief tenure there. Frank Vetrano.
Yep.
Who does Frank Vetrano play for?
He plays for the Anaheim Ducks.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
It absolutely is, yeah.
Especially because he just signed some weird extension in which he doesn't get paid for like 15 years.
Yeah. Love signing those contracts.
Yeah, love to defer payment. Only for them to hire the coach who didn't have enough time for me that the club didn't prioritize extending me. There's a lot of, like, put it this way. Even though Strickland rather quickly walked back his report, I actually think there's a lot to chew on and something pretty interesting to consider in him talking about the Anaheim Ducks. Like, there are players on the Anaheim Ducks, even if it's not Troy Terry specifically, although I would say Terry, given his style of play and frame, sort of fits in a box where if, you know, and like the Kreider trade's another dead giveaway, right? About like sort of what this team's going to value. And where Quenneville and Verbeek might be aligned in terms of what they value.
The Trouba trade.
If you were to tell me that Troy Terry ends up being less indispensable in terms of how the Ducks think about their own team and priorities long term, like, that makes sense to me. I immediately think, yeah, that could happen. Frank Vatrano is the other guy, right? He's got this three-year deal, this new three-year deal. He has no trade protection. We know that Quenneville was the coach.
All right, we just lost Trance there with a jaunty little sound effect from his computer on the way out. That was very nice. We'll reconnect with Trance here in just a second as we discuss the potential implications of Troy Terry being on the market. And again, and thank you to Trance for encouraging me to refresh the tweet there from Andy Strickland. The addition to his report was a team spokesperson reached out and says Terry is not available, so we'll see if anything comes out of it. Was told by an individual with a different team. Now, that is very fascinating to me because that individual could just be wrong, but it also could be a result of that other unnamed different team having conversations with Anaheim about a potential trade and them not shutting the door on Troy Terry, right? Them being willing to talk about including Troy Terry. And so this is where you start to get into the semantics of, well, Troy Terry is available. Does that mean they're shopping him, or does that just mean that they're willing to listen? And if you're hearing it from an individual with a different team, perhaps they were listening on conversations around Troy Terry in trade talks. So, Drance, we have you back.
I had so much momentum. That was a tough moment to just suddenly disconnect. I apologize to our listeners and to you, Jamie.
That's all right.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's, again, I'm really appreciative to Strickland. I appreciate the correction. You know, we're not like taking that intel to the bank, given what he himself added in terms of details to it, right? But I actually think there's a lot there that, you know, is pretty fascinating from our perspective, right?
Yeah, no, it is. It's a fascinating report. And the other angle I was wondering about, right, because Troy Terry, far and away, the biggest contract they have on the books when you look at total dollars left on it, right? He's signed $7 million per season through 2030. They only have one other deal on the books that even goes to 2028, and that's Frank Vatrano. So Troy Terry has got an extra 2 years on any other contract on Anaheim's books. But you start to look at the list of guys who will need second contracts, RFAs, this year and next, and it is almost a staggeringly long list of a lot of guys who are tracking well, right? Like up front, I'm not even going to include Trevor Zegras in here, even though he's technically on the list of a guy who will need a new contract. But in terms of the younger players, the next wave, Mason McTavish, RFA right now, needs a new deal. Cutter Gauthier and Leo Carlson, one more year left on their ELC, so they're extension eligible as of July 1st. They need a new deal going into not this coming season, but the next one after that. In goal, Lucas Dostal is an RFA. He needs a new contract. On the blue line, Jackson Lacombe, Pavel Minchukov, and Olin Zellweger all have 1 year left on their entry-level deals. They need new contracts going into, again, the season following this. Like, that's a lot of potential building block players all coming up for, and not all of those guys will they want to go long term with, but a lot of them they probably want to go long term with. And if you're a prospect like Leo Carlson or Mason McTavish or Cutter Gauthier, considering your draft pedigree, considering some of the results those players have had early in their careers, if you're talking a long-term deal in this new cap environment, those are going to be very, very pricey contracts. And it's not as if they couldn't do all of those deals with Troy Terry still on the books. But on the face of it, you look at Anaheim and think, well, what are you talking about? They've got so much cap space. Why would they be interested in clearing cap? But you look at the amount of work they have to do with their young players and the guys who I assume they want to be, you know, the building blocks of the next core for that team. Like, that's going to be a lot of money committed in pretty short order here, assuming they do want to commit long term to a lot of those players.
Yeah, which is why I can't credit it appropriately, but someone was pouring cold water on them as a Marner suitor. Here's another one, by the way, that I want to get into. Was it Frank yesterday, Frank Saravalli, who was talking about the idea that Marner might not sign on July 1, but yes, might like take his time.
Do the whole like dog and pony show and bring people in to pitch and that whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not, again, this is me talking about how I think about these things as opposed to like spitting facts. Okay. I want to be very clear before I get into this, but you know what my immediate reaction is to that?
What?
Oh, that means he's going to Vegas.
To give them time to clear up, to solve their issues and clear up space.
the only other time that Vegas has really like dipped in to July 1, because mostly this team has been built, I mean, you know, through expansion, but also through trades.
The trade deadline.
Right?
Yeah. In-season trades, specifically.
So the key UFA guys that they signed, right? I mean, you know, there's like some Tanner Pearsons and some other guys like that. But the key guy that they signed was Pietrangelo.
Yeah.
And when they signed Pietrangelo in the fall of 2020, right? That was that weird, like, October 13th free agent day. They signed him, like, days after the market had opened because they needed time for the market to unfold a certain way and for Vancouver to trade for Nate Schmidt.
Yep.
Like, that's – they needed time to make the math work. And so – I'm not saying that like Carolina or the other teams that plan on LA, the other teams that plan on making a big push to land Marner are out of the running by any means. But history tells us that when you're signing with Vegas, you need to be a little bit patient. It takes a little bit of time. There's probably another shoe to drop to make sure that it all works. So the moment I heard that, I was like, oh, no, I think Marner's coming to the Pacific. And again, that's just my gut reaction based on the history and sort of how this stuff works. That's not me reporting anything or predicting anything. That was just my reaction to that report. It was like, oh, well, it's Vegas.
Well, there was also the Friedman mention of, you know, some of his teammates think he's heading west, right? So that fits with Vegas. I still look at LA as a fit that makes a ton of sense and probably wouldn't have to do as many of the gymnastics that we're talking about with Vegas. But if you want to go to the team that gives you the best opportunity to win and is also willing to kind of move heaven and earth and do what needs to be done to give you your money and pay you, Vegas makes a lot of sense. Like, you start to add all of the start to consider all of the breadcrumbs together that we're kind of hearing and the bits and pieces, and who knows, right? This could all go a different way. We hear Carolina is going to be a big bidder. I expect there will be other teams involved as well, but like the two teams that I would have ranked 1 and 2 most likely to land Mitch Marner right now are LA and Vegas, and probably Vegas number one, to be honest, with LA second.
That's bad news, man. This is probably the top unrestricted free agent we've seen hit the market since Artemi Panarin. And there's actually a stylistic similarity there. You've seen the sort of impact that Panarin had on the New York Rangers, who've been in the conference final since signing him, maybe twice off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. So I mean, this is not great news. Not good. Not great, Jamie. If Marner is heading west and the Canucks aren't likely to get a meeting, you know, which I don't know if they are likely to get a meeting or not. But I can tell you that in addressing the top six forward needs, they've always been pretty pessimistic about the unrestricted free agent route internally, which suggests to me that they're probably going to have a tough time elbowing their way into the Marner sweepstakes.
Yeah, I mean, the other conversation then is if it is Vegas, is there at least a way that you can be a secondary winner, right? Whoever shakes loose. And I know we've talked about Nick Waugh. You know, we've talked about William Karlsson and probably how it's unlikely to be him. I look at like an Ivan Barbashev in that scenario as well.
Yeah, that one's interesting.
And the Canucks, correct me if I'm wrong here, but this front office has liked Barbashev in the past as well, right?
You know what? I don't know specifically. I mean, I think they were interested but kind of lukewarm on him back in like the former regime during that expansion process when they were talking trades with like Dallas and some of the other clubs. Barbashev was a favorite of mine when we were doing that, the whole like, how do you use expansion in your favor?
Sure, 'cause
the Canucks
sure.
don't have enough good players to protect. But I think they were pretty lukewarm. I don't know how the new regime feels. Barbashev would seem to fit, you know, the template of like, you know who I bet you loves Ivan Barbashev? Adam Foote.
Yes.
Whether the organization itself, I don't know specifically, so I'm reluctant to comment on
maybe
it.
Maybe I'm just assuming they like him because he's a Gold Star client.
Right.
I'm just assuming that there's a connection there, but that might not be fair.
No, I mean, I think it's totally fair. They don't have a lot of Gold Star guys these days, though.
No,
Jamie.
They don't. I know. I don't know if that relationship is fractured or not. Maybe I should go the opposite. Maybe I should go
he
the
used
opposite
to be the
way.
Assistant general manager.
I know.
The problem is I would suspect, like, first of all, the Pietrangelo factor. Does he end up on LTI?
Yep.
right? That's going to loom large in sort of shaping this exactly and exactly what they need to do. There's already some reports out there about Nick Hague, the left-handed defender, can play both sides, big, physical, really good, like really good at trolling people too, about his availability. I just feel like, man, Nick Hague, like he's going to have a market. You know, you look at a team like Carolina, right, who probably wants to be bigger after their experience in the playoffs this past year, right? And they've got all these young defenders coming. They've got Orlov expiring. I don't remember if Gostis Bears expiring or if he has 1 year, but nonetheless, like, you're not outbidding a team like Carolina for Nick Hague, you know? So it's a little bit complicated there. But there's some pretty interesting options here for sure in Vegas. But Nick Waugh would be the one, though, right? Like center, yes. Right-handed, 28. Yes. I mean, I'm pretty sure he can be a second-line guy and be immediately really, really good. He's just kind of been buried on a deep team on the third line, but he's an overqualified bottom six guy. Look, they were able to pull it off with Nate Schmidt. I actually think this is an interesting market. Like, if the Canucks aren't going to be the team getting Ehlers or getting a Duchesne or getting one of the top guys, and I'm not saying they're not going to be, like, I think there's a chance that they are in on some of those players or what have you. But I do think this market of facilitating the teams that are going to get the prize, facilitating their acquisition of that player, I think that's a pretty interesting market to potentially be in. Like, we'll see what the New York Rangers do, for example. You know, but there's a ton of noise around guys like around Keandre Miller, which is really interesting. There's also Will Cooley. You know, I don't know that there's a huge gap in quality, totally honest with you, given the disparity in who both guys played with and just how, you know, physically assertive and impactful both guys are. I don't know that there's that big a gap. This is going to seem like such a hot take, but I promise you it's fair. I don't know that there's that big a gap in, like, potential and upside between Will Cooley and Matt Nyes.
Wow. All right. Yeah. I think that's fair.
He had 45 points.
Yeah.
You know, and he's awesome. Like, he's a really good player. They're not going to want to. I mean, I think that's more that feels more like an offer sheet possibility, like an offer sheet target. Yeah. Which, you know, I don't think we expect the Canucks to necessarily be in that market. But it does feel like more of that because I can't see the Rangers wanting to deal a guy with his profile and his sort of, like, physical gumption. Those are the sorts of, like, if the Rangers find themselves on the precipice of being able to do something really, really significant, I would argue that Cooley, for example, was even better than it sort of looked, in part because he was often tasked with playing, you know, alongside some guys like Zibanejad, whose 5-on-5 fastball is, like, rapidly deteriorated, right? Like, he was propping stuff up in New York, in my opinion anyway. And that's partly why I think, you know, there's a big difference between propping up Zibanejad at this stage of his career versus playing with Matthews and Marner.
Yeah.
Right? Which is why I think the gap is narrower than people realize.
Yep.
But, like, that to me is, like, a really, like, you want to land the sort of competitor, right, that we're talking about when you watch the Florida Panthers play. Like, to me, that's the guy, not just the Canucks, like, 15 teams should be all in on pushing to see what they can shake loose out of New York, depending on what else New York has to accomplish and where they have to sort of play defense in assembling their roster over the course of the summer.
Quickly, before we go here, what do you make of the continued connections between Bowen Byram and the Canucks? Adrian Dater yesterday, longtime Colorado Avalanche reporter, saying he thinks Bowen Byram wants to be a Canuck. I know they were talking about it with Frank Saravalli on Canucks Central yesterday. I don't really see the fit. I understand the interest in the talent. What's your read on the situation?
Sure. Like, I don't know. Like, what's the fit?
Yeah. I guess where I've landed is, like, I understand if you just really love the player, go get the player you really love and then figure out the fit. Like, if that's how it's sold, if that
love him,
if that was how it was spun, I'm like, okay, I can see that. It's not really, I don't know, but that's really how his front office has tended to operate so much, right? Like, there's been a fit priority for them typically, and you're spending resources that you desperately need up front. So it doesn't really make sense. But again, there's worse things than just going out and targeting the players you think are hyper talented.
Well, especially if the report is that he wants to play in Vancouver.
Sure.
It's like, heck yeah.
Yeah. We could use a little bit of
there's
that.
There's a guy who doesn't care about state taxes. Everyone assured me that all anyone cared about was state taxes. Yeah. Players consider things other than state taxes, Jamie?
Yeah. Apparently.
No. Apparently. That can't be right. That's a lie. I don't believe that for a second. Anyway,
Bowen Byron's the one guy.
I mean, great. Like, anyone who wants to come to Vancouver, you should prioritize acquiring, in my mind. Like, I think this organization needs some guys who really want to be here and who understand what it means in this city and welcome that challenge and that opportunity. Like, that's great. To me, that's a selling point. That's like, yes, perfect. We don't have to capture a guy. There's a guy who gets it. And I think Bowen Byram's really, really good. I think he struggled massively in Buffalo, but I don't think we should overread in anyone's defensive struggles in that Buffalo system, given the way that that team has played. I think he's awesome. That would be great. Like, yeah, they should absolutely knock on those doors or explore that, do their diligence. It's just really difficult to see a fit, given mm-hmm. that I'm sure he's not going to be free, considering his upside and what the Florida, what the Buffalo Sabres traded away to get him.
Yeah. All right. Before we go here, as a reminder, I mentioned that Dan and Sat are in Abbotsford at Boston Pizza for the Abbey Canucks Calder Cup final game tonight. Not only that, they're going to be hosting an hour-long post-game show live from the Abbotsford Center. And guess what? Thursday and Saturday, they'll be hosting pre- and post-game coverage at the rink. So, extended Abbey Canucks coverage here on the station. Again, we'll play the start of Stanley Cup Final Game 6 tonight on the show, then go to Abbotsford for game 3 of that series, and an hour post-game show with Dan and Sat on Canucks Central. And we will be back tomorrow on a crossover Wednesday with Jason Buchel as well to break it all down here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.